Hello, everyone, and welcome. My name's Catherine Barnard. I'm Professor of European Union Law and Employment Law here at the University of Cambridge. I'm very pleased to welcome all of you who are kindly joining us online to discuss this very important decision of the Supreme Court for Women Scotland and the Scottish Ministers. I've got huge pleasure to introduce you to you our two speakers. First, Aidan O'Neill KC, who appeared and represented for Women Scotland, who's going to go first and is going to talk a bit about the background to the case and the arguments that led to the ultimate success for his clients. He will speak for about 20 minutes and will be followed by Lena Holzer, one of our excellent colleagues here in the law faculty, who's assistant professor in gender, race and the law, and she is going to also speak for about 15-20 minutes. That will leave time for questions at the end. Please, if you've got questions, could you put them in the Q&A, and I will try and get through as many of the questions as possible. Apologies if I don't get to yours. But what I would like to do now, just before Aidan starts to speak, my colleague Dan Bates, who's very kindly helped with a number of aspects of this, is going to put up Aidan's speaking note in the chat, I think, so that you can see where Aidan is going in his talk. Aidan, the floor is yours, and thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thanks very much, Catherine, and thanks to everybody who joined us in this. As Catherine said, this is an academic seminar, and I'm not an academic, so slightly fish out of water for me. But I thought it might be quite interesting for those of you who are academics and are teaching law students to get the, as it were, given there's a lot of interest in this case, to get a slightly different perspective, which is that of the legal practitioner who was involved in pursuing the case. And I've been involved in the case for rather a long time, for over 5 years. So although the issues and the judgment might have come as as something of a bolt from the blue for a number of people, it's something I've been working on seriously with my clients for Women Scotland. As I say, for a number of years, in fact, have taken two judicial review applications for them, both of which ultimately were successful. Both have to be understood. You cannot understand the Supreme Court decision in For Women Scotland 2 unless you've also understood and read the For Women Scotland 1 decision of the Inner House. But it's been a long journey. And frankly, the clients who instructed me, who put their faith in me to represent them, have been remarkable in their tenacity and their, frankly, the cogency of their legal analysis. Everything which I have done in terms of the argumentation, which was developed over time, has been very much been done in consultation with the now three women who were the directors of For Women Scotland, and their views were very much, I made sure that everything which I said is that they had approved of, and also that I took on board everything which they wanted me to say as far as possible. As I say, it's been a long journey in that the whole matter really started in 2017, so 8 years ago, when the Scottish ministers consulted on a draft bill to try and improve the representation of women on non-public boards and non-executive positions in Scotland. Sounds incredibly niche. It was incredibly niche, and it's slightly odd that there was such a lot of political capital put into this, because, as it turns out, statistically, women were underrepresented, but not by large margins in these positions. But in any event, a consultation was put out for this new bill between January and March 2017. The original bill, as drafted, said It was putting for a gender representation objective for a public board, and it said that that meant that 50% of non-executive members who are female or who identify as female, and there should be 50% of members who are male or who identify as male. That went into consultation. Again, there wasn't that much interaction with it, but the Equality and Human Rights Commission came back and said, slightly confusing language in that you seem to be confusing sex and gender, and you're including women, but also those who identify as women. So can we clear up on that? And the response of the Scottish government was, okay, we'll just not have a definition of women at all. And the bill that was then produced to the Scottish Parliament and promoted before it had no definition of women. It was just 50% should be women in terms of the gender representation objective. However, when the matter went to committee stage, what then happened is that the Equality Network and the Scottish Trans Alliance came in and gave evidence about how it was important that there should be inclusivity for trans women in any such positive action measure in the workplace. And one should be aware, in Scotland, being a relatively small country, the civil society is not particularly well developed. And insofar as there are civil society bodies, they are largely funded by the Scottish government. So the Scottish Trans Network, the Equality Network and the like, are bodies whose most of their funding comes from the Scottish government, as are other, as it were, stakeholders. There isn't really an independent third sector. And so you get this, the development of a rather a close relationship with civil servants and those who get the grants to be the sounding out, as it were, externally as to what should happen. And there has been a development, frankly, of policy capture, whereby the same individuals, the same groups are consulted upon. The consultations as stakeholders, it goes out to people whose organisations are funded by the Scottish government, and one of the conditions for the maintenance of those grants is that they don't criticise Scottish government policy. Anyway, so what then happened is that the proposal was made to have a new definition of women to specifically include trans women. So it was to the proposal was to a wording that the gender recognition representation objective will be reached if a person is living as a woman and is proposing to undergo or has undergone a process for the purposes of becoming female. So include trans women, but then specifically to exclude trans men. And this was all said to be part of the underlying Scottish government policy to be as inclusive as possible of trans women. Our women was the one of the slogans of, adopted by the Scottish government. So they were happy with these amendments and they were adopted and it all went through and nobody really noticed. The Act was passed in 2018, but it didn't come into force really for another 2 years. And it was only subsequent to it being passed and then there being a new public consultation on the guidance which was being produced by Scottish ministers, that in fact some public notice was taken of it. And in fact, my client then said, is it possible then to challenge the definition in this Act and the associated guidance? The immediate problem with that, of course, is that normally judicial reviews have to be taken within 3 months, and it rather looked as though we had failed to get in within the time limit. But we made enough of an argument to say that, well, the guidance is expanding upon the statutory definition, and if we brought it within 3 months of that, we could bring it. And so we did manage to get into court. We lost at first instance in the on appeal. We were upheld by the Inner House. They said, they accepted our argument, that what was happening here was a confusion between two separate characteristics in the Equality Act, gender reassignment, and sex, and that because Section 14, I think it is, of the Equality Act had never been brought into force, which is the provision that allows for two groups or individuals to be determined by a reference to two protected characteristics, then the what had happened here was that some people have the definition was confusing the sex by adding in a gender reassignment, and therefore was taking some people out, women who had the protected characteristics of gender reassignment from a positive action measure for women. Anyway, the argument was accepted, and therefore the first judicial review was upheld. Now, importantly, the Scottish ministers decided not to attempt to appeal that decision, as they could have done. They could have applied to the Inner House for permission to go to the Supreme Court, but they decided not to. And instead, what was done, I think, I don't know, I'm not privy to the internal workings of how the government, Scottish government works, but what instead seemed to be prioritised was making it easier for gender recognition certificates to be obtained by individuals. And so that's the bill that was then promoted before the Scottish Parliament, and new guidance was brought out from the Scottish government saying, just having the protected characteristic of gender reassignment is not going to change your sex, but if you get a gender recognition certificate, that will change your sex, and we're going to make it far easier to get a gender recognition certificate. So that then meant that there was an absolute clear and almost exam question for academics as to what exactly Section 9(1) of the Gender Recognition Act meant when it said that a gender recognition certificate changes an individual's gender and sex for all purposes. Everybody always focused on Section 9(1) of the Gender Recognition Act. Nobody seemed to pay much attention to Section 9(3), which says that's subject to any enactment. It was a slightly odd provision, that carve-out, because at some levels you could think, that's all that is doing is empowering the ministers to make regulations to apply the carve-out. And it was, in fact, used for those purposes. There are some regulations to that effect. But it wasn't just limited as a regulatory power. It was saying subject to any enactment. No notice seemed to have been paid to that. So we picked up and ran with that, saying, in fact, 9(3) is important here. And the Equality Act, when read in a holistic, coherent fashion, can only mean sex, meaning biologically, because otherwise the various provisions, in particular the carve-outs for women's rights, which existed, would not work. So that was the argument. That was the argument that was run. But of course, what was run against the background that there really the weight of, if you opened up any book written by academics and practitioners, everybody said that the gender recognition certificate changed sex for the purposes of the Equality Act. And there seemed to be ECJ authority, there seemed to be European Court of Human Rights authority, there was authority from the House of Lords. So we're going against all of that in an attempt to push against the tide. So it was quite a challenging argument to make. But I had to find a new way of trying to grab the attention of the courts towards that. And what I did somewhat controversially and unusually is that I then, particularly before the Supreme Court, I then said, well, look, there's a whole line of authority, past authority, common law statements, which are wholly against my position. Now, you don't normally refer to precedent because it doesn't help you. But actually what it did, because when one looked at those precedents from the 1870s onwards on how women could participate in public life, you saw a pattern whereby legislation and regulations which sought to bring women closer into public life were then being systematically undermined by the judiciary, saying, don't be ridiculous, ours, we've got this strong common law tradition that when being a woman is a legal disability. So one cannot expect that these regulations, which apparently empower women, can be used to allow women to go to university, for example, or when women eventually did get to university and it required legislative change, when they graduated, they then said, well, they're graduates and there are parliamentary constituencies for the universities. I think John Buchan was the MP for the Universities of Scotland. And it says any graduate of the university can vote. We're women, we've graduated, we're a person, so we can vote for the university constituencies. And the judges said, don't be ridiculous. When they said person, they could never have intended women because that would have given them the right to vote. You know that women can't vote. So you look at that past case law, and I brought it to the court's attention and said, well, look, that's what we're up against, actually. There's this habit, this muscle memory of when you're looking at statutory provisions, it is to find, if at all possible, against a woman's rights reading of it. So the argument was rhetorically, if you find against us in this case, you're just doing the same again. You're just doing what the old common law position has been. And frankly, that's to be on the wrong side of history. Don't do that. Constitutional courts, top courts, courts generally, don't want to be on the wrong side of history. They know that their decisions are always going to be looked back at, and some will be regarded as good decisions, Donoghue against Stevenson. Some are going to be bad decisions, Dred Scott against Sanford in the Supreme Court. So in terms of the rhetoric of all this, that I was very much saying this is an arc of history that you want to be on the right side of, and the right side in this case is in favour of interpretation, in favour of my clients. So in a sense, one used the fact that the common law was against one as strengthening one's own argument. So it was rather paradoxical. It was like some kind of judo move whereby you use the person's strength to knock them over. At least that was my concept of it. So that was the general run of things. And I've set it out more fully in the speaking note, which is available as to what was happening. But of course, if you read the judgment, you'll find none of that at all. None of that big argument about this is where the common law has taken us, and this is what happens if you don't accept a women's rights perspective. But I'd said to the court, look, this is the context, and the law context is everything it always told. This is the real context, the proper historical context. So always decide against that and against where your decision will be seen in the future. But it would be problematic, of course, for the court to then say, these are all the common law precedents which are against us, because it goes against the whole notion of a court, saying we never innovate, we always follow and slightly, you know, tweak the past wisdom of the ages. Whereas in this case, I was saying, actually, you know, you've got to have a formal repudiation of that approach, a recognition of it, first of all, and then a repudiation of it. And that hasn't been done explicitly. It's silent. The court is utterly silent on the arguments that are put there. The case reports don't even refer to all the cases which they were referred to thus far. And if you read the judgment, you wouldn't see any hint of this. But the fact is, we won the case. So in a sense, what I would say that it's that looking at judgments, one can't always understand them simply within the four corners of what is actually said and the reasoning that is actually presented. That the context can be bigger and broader in terms of what has been argued before it. And I would say this because, you know, I did the arguing. This is pretty much that case where there's an invisible aspect to this judgment, which in which the court is conscious that it is actually making a significant change and a significant intervention in the law in a way which goes contrary to much of the received wisdom thus far. But they were persuaded round to doing that. But of course, it is then that wasn't just the historical argument was, in a sense, simply a way of grabbing their attention. At least that was my attempt. Stop and think. This is what's happened before when women's rights issues have been brought before the courts with a very similar demographic as existed in 1870 in terms of the judiciary. And one should guard against falling into those older ways. Having said that, then let's now look at the four corners of the statute. This is, can it work coherently in any proper way? No. And so, as it turns out, history is on, not just is on my side, but in any event, you can make it black letter, four square and simple, and decide in our favour. And of course, yeah, they decided in our favour. Having said that, the interventions were significant in this case, and were given significant weight. The court was incredibly grateful, in fact, to Sex Matters for pointing a way in which they could see that there was going to be no detriment to trans people by the manner in which the sex discrimination was now going to be applied, because it was always still possible for individuals to claim sex discrimination, even if they were not of the sex, by association with the sex, or because there are presumptions by appearance that they're of a particular sex. So therefore, in a sense, the court could comfort himself with that by saying, actually, we're just clarifying things, we're ensuring women's rights, and there isn't really any great detriment on the trans rights front. Anyway, I think I've spoken enough, have I?
Thank you. That was magnificent, and I really appreciated the background, which I hadn't been aware of prior to you mentioning, in the sense of how you'd actually cast the argument, which was fascinating. There's a question that's come in on the Q&A, which is directly relevant to your very last remark, so I thought I might just bring it in there before I turn to Lena. You said that the Supreme Court was very grateful to Sex Matters. One of the criticisms that's been raised, and this is what the questioner says, that the Good Law Project says there was no opportunity for trans people to have their verses heard at trial. You might want to just address that point. Given how much was put forward, as Mr. O'Neill has said, on behalf of the Four Women organisation, as well as several interveners on behalf of their case, does he think this will result in a successful challenge in the ECA, in the Court of Human Rights?
Yeah, I mean, I've looked into this, and frankly, no. You know, I mean, I as a hired gun, I'm more than happy to argue any argument. If somebody instructs me. So I have thought about this. I think the complaint is that there were interveners allowed on the gender critical side, and trans voices weren't heard. But in fact, there was a strong and all the interventions there, but Amnesty International's intervention was very, very strongly on the need to accept and preserve the dignity of trans people. The Scottish ministers were absolutely unequivocal on those matters. They were continuing with their policy, which had been going on since at least the past 10 years of the dignity of and needing to have the perspective of the most marginalised of groups in terms of trans women. In fact, they pled the principle of legality, and both Amnesty and the Scottish ministers were very strong in saying that there are fundamental rights at play here of trans people. The ECHR jurisprudence is all there. So the arguments were fully before the court. There's absolutely no doubt about that. The other argument is that, I think that two individuals who applied weren't given permission, Stephen Whittle and Victoria McLeod, to give their talk about their experience as trans individuals who had GRCs. But you know, this was an appeal, second level of appeal on a judicial review. It wasn't about the evidence, frankly, and it would also been incredibly difficult for the court to take on board or for us to challenge. It would have been rather unfair to us. Anecdotal accounts of what it meant, as opposed to whereas we hadn't lots of anecdotal accounts from women as to what things meant. This was very much focusing on statutory construction and those arguments, and the fundamental rights arguments, and the EU law arguments were all there. And it was a 2-day hearing, which was unusual for it. So it just happens to be that the case was found in our favour, as opposed to, for all sorts of reasons, no doubt. I would say because of the brilliance of my argument, but others may think otherwise.
That goes without saying. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for addressing that. Lena, may I turn to you now?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Thank you very much, Catherine, and to the FELS team for organizing this today. And thank you, Aydin, for setting the scene and explaining the background to the case. I might come back to this question, which was just raised later, but let me just kind of share my views. So I was invited to share my views on the case. And actually, until yesterday, I had prepared some analysis of the judgment by the UK Supreme Court. But then yesterday, the Equality and Human Rights Commission actually published a new draft code of practice that gives guidance on how to interpret the judgment by the Supreme Court. This draft is not final yet, but there's a consultation process in the next 6 weeks where people can send their comments on this code of practice. But I think I will focus a little bit on this code of practice because it will bring to light some of the issues that the judgment raises, some of the controversies and consequences of the ruling. So what I will do is that I will briefly explain how the Equality Act has been interpreted until now in the last 15 years, and then focus on these consequences and end with thinking about what are the challenges to the consequences raised from a human rights perspective. So the Equality Act of 2010 has been implemented in the last 15 years by different practitioners, by different service providers on the ground. And I think there's often a misunderstanding how it has worked. So obviously the Equality Act provides a general prohibition on the base of discrimination on the basis of sex, but at the same time, it also provides so-called sex-based exceptions to this general prohibition. So in specific areas, such as in service provision or in communal accommodation, one can make a difference on the basis of sex in order to, for example, provide single-sex services. And arguments brought forward by For Women Scotland and other so-called gender-critical feminists say that excluding trans women from these women-only spaces and services is necessary to protect women's spaces and services, to protect cisgender women, to protect their dignity and privacy. And an example that is often provided is that rape shelters or domestic violence services must be able to exclude trans women from these shelters or services, because otherwise the cisgender women needing the services are, for example, re-traumatized by the presence of individuals who are read or perceived as men and who would otherwise not attend the services if trans women are included. So let's look at how the Equality Act has actually dealt, or the interpretation and the implementation of the Equality Act has dealt with this scenario until now. So under Schedule 3, paragraph 28 of the Equality Act, we know that there is an exception as regards discrimination basis of gender reassignment in relation to single-sex services, if a certain conduct in question is a proportionate means for achieving a legitimate aim. So what this means in practice is that a trans person can be excluded from a single-sex service, or that's what was the interpretation until now. A trans person can be excluded from a single-sex service because of being trans if this is a proportionate means for achieving a legitimate aim. So to come back to kind of my example, the practice has mostly been that trans women, for example, could be excluded from women-only services such as shelters if the exclusion would be a proportionate means for achieving a legitimate aim. And that could mean that some women shelters could be trans-exclusive in order to kind of cater to another population of women and make sure that another population would be able to attend these services, which would otherwise maybe not attend if trans women were included. So I think what this shows is that until now, the implementation of the Act has actually provided service providers who are the ones on the ground making the decision to design the services to women in a way in order to reach the highest number of women in a specific context, depending on the different various needs of the specific populations of women. We know that intersectionality plays a strong role in the need of women to access certain women-only services, such as shelters. So gender discrimination here intersects with class discrimination and religious discrimination, discrimination on basis of race, disability, and gender identity. So we have a diverse group of women who all need, for example, sometimes some women-only services. And service providers were put in a position to actually navigate these group of women and to decide whether excluding, for example, trans women from very specific services would be proportionate. Obviously, based on this proportionality logic enshrined in human rights, one would also need to think about, so where can then women who are excluded go and what are the other services available to them? And this interpretation of the Equality Act has been also proposed and supported by the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which has proposed this interpretation in the Code of Practice, which was laid before Parliament in 2010 and then became final in 2011. So then what are the consequences of this judgment or this practice? The UK Supreme Court has interpreted the Equality Act in a way that makes it in accordance with the Act if service providers exclude trans women from women-only services without this exclusion necessarily having to be a proportionate means for achieving a legitimate aim. And we also know that the Equality and Human Rights Commission has gone further and interpreted the judgment as creating an obligation on service providers and workplaces to exclude trans women from women-only services and spaces. So I think most of you have heard about this interim update, which the Equality and Human Rights Commission provided relatively briefly after the judgment. And in this update, the commission focuses on excluding trans women from women's bathrooms. But as I said in the beginning yesterday, actually, the commission also issued draft, like new code of practices, which is a statutory guidance, which you can issue under the Equality Act of 2006 under Section 14. The Secretary of State must approve this code of practice, and then a copy must be laid before Parliament before the code of practice becomes final. And here again, in this code of practice, we can see that the EHRC interprets the judgment as creating an obligation for all single-sex services to exclude trans women from women-only services. But actually, what is interesting is also that the EHRC in this revised code of practice actually tries to deal with the practical consequences of the judgment. Because what the Supreme Court said is that it kind of created clarity for the implementation of the Equality Act as regards single-sex services, for example, or sex-based exceptions. And it said that defining sex as biological sex was the only way to provide this clarity. And what we can actually see now in the aftermath quite clearly, but what was actually quite clear from the beginning on when the judgment was issued, is that instead of providing clarity, actually, the definition of sex has become really unworkable and has become really burdensome on the service providers who make the decisions. Because the UK Supreme Court said that sex means biological sex under the Equality Act. The notion of biological sex has not existed as such before in the law, and it was also not defined by the Supreme Court what is exactly meant with biological sex. So the EHRC now, yesterday in the revised Code of Practice, states clearly that biological sex is actually sex assigned at birth. It's a sex which is noted on the original birth certificate issued after birth. Okay, having clarified that, the question arises, how does one prove one's sex assigned at birth? How can service providers find out whether somebody is transgender or cisgender? And until a few days ago, I was jokingly saying a few times that, well, in the end, women will just need to run around with the birth certificate. But actually, since yesterday, this idea of having to produce a birth certificate when entering a bathroom or being accepted in a hospital does not seem to be that far-fetched anymore, because the EHRC clearly says in its updated code of practice that if there is concern about the accuracy of the response to the question about one's sex assigned at birth, that service providers could request a birth certificate. However, then the EHSC also notes that a birth certificate does not necessarily reflect the sex assigned at birth of a person, because precisely we have the Gender Recognition Act, which allows individuals to receive a gender recognition certificate, which then can be used to rectify or change the gender marker on the birth certificate. So then the EHSC says, in such circumstances when one has provided a birth certificate, but there's this suspicion that the person actually has a GSC, then further inquiries are needed, such as confirmation as to whether a person has a GSC. But at the same time, the Supreme Court judgment says in several instances that the fact of possessing a GSC is confidential to the person who has it and subject to stringent restriction on disclosure under Section 22 of the Gender Recognition Act. So now we have a situation where service providers might have to ask about the birth certificate of a person, then have to inquire whether the person has a GSC, but based on the Supreme Court judgment, having a GSC is actually confidential information. I don't know how other people feel in the call. I think it's rather unrealistic that service providers will do this on an everyday basis when they have already other many things to do. But I might be surprised. I have been surprised quite a lot in the last few months. So actually, I think what is more realistic is that in the end, access to women-only spaces is determined by whether somebody looks like a real woman and therefore does not raise suspicion of being trans. So isn't it in the end about passing as cisgender? And that really raises the problem that we might actually reinforce stereotypical definitions of how a woman looks like. And we know that since the rights of trans persons have become such a hot topic in the public debate and media debate in the last 8-10 years, there are increasing testimonies of women, including cisgender women and trans women, of having been harassed in women's toilets for not presenting women enough and for having their presence questioned. So also, for example, masculine presenting cisgender women are in fact increasingly affected by this kind of gender policing. And I do want to raise the question whether this doesn't go against the feminist objective to define women less by how they look like in the end. So what I want to focus on now is quickly, so now we have this code of practice, and we will see certain human rights challenges to this code of practice. We already know that the Good Law Project has initiated a judicial review proceedings against this interim update. It has sent a letter as part of the pre-action protocol. And as part of the challenge, there are several grounds mentioned, for example, that the EHSC has wrongfully interpreted the law, specifically the workplace regulations, and therefore has failed to comply with its duty under the Equality Act of 2006. But then the letter also says that in case the Commission has complied with the duty and has not provided a wrongful interpretation, then the Good Law Project calls upon the Administrative Court to rely on Section 3 and Section 4 of the Human Rights Act to either read down specific laws or to issue a declaration of incompatibility as regards to the Gender Recognition Act of 2004, the Equality Act, and these workplace regulations. And this really highlights one of the core kind of branches of critique which has been raised against the judgment. So I think one can see kind of two broader strands of critique which commentators have raised. One is the issue of statutory interpretation and the sources which the UK Supreme Court has not engaged with in order to, which could have been aids to find out the meaning of sex in context. And the second kind of branch of critique is really that the Supreme Court has not engaged carefully with the ECHR position on legal gender recognition and has not engaged with the question whether it can rely on Section 3 of the Human Rights Act to read down the definition of sex, if it is if sex is biological sex, in order to make the Equality Act compliant with ECHR case law on legal gender recognition. And that is important because the situation which we are having now in the UK is that actually trans persons, if the code of practice will become final and will be implemented as such, trans persons will have to out themselves in very mundane, public, everyday human interactions, such as when they are going to the bathroom, such as when entering a hospital. And legal gender recognition, the right to legal gender recognition under Article 8 of the ECHR, a core element of that is that trans persons should not have the obligation and do not need to out themselves on an everyday basis as trans, because being outed as trans precisely kind of creates situations of discrimination and also even violence. So here we will have challenges against these kind of follow-up consequences from the Supreme Court from a human rights perspective. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed for that really interesting perspective and touching upon some of the really rather difficult consequences of the judgment. I encourage people to put questions in on the Q&A. There have been two quite detailed questions here for you, Aidan. I don't know if you can you see them in front of you? I think the audience can. You can't. They're in the Q&A box. So
all right. Shall I press that button? Oh yes, I see that. Okay. Yeah, I see them now. Yes, thank you.
So I'll just give you a chance to digest them. I'll just briefly read them. Eve Haynes says, you mentioned that the question was purely one of statutory interpretation, and that's one of the reasons why the anecdotal evidence of trans people would have been difficult to deal with in the context of the trial, but also noted that the party Aidan was representing had a lot of anecdotal evidence on the part of women and the effect that this would have on them. I find this difficult to reconcile as the experience of cisgender women should be taken into account, including interveners such as lesbian groups. Surely it would have been appropriate to have heard from the experiences of trans people rather than cis people, non-trans specific organisations speaking on their behalf. Do you want to address that one? And then there's another question on slightly similar lines.
Okay. In terms of, as I say, it was a judicial review and it was taken. And judicial reviews are not normally cases in which there are evidence is brought or heard. My clients didn't bring any evidence as such, but they did point out and go through how would these particular provisions for example, separate sex services, which are predicated on considerations of privacy and decency, how would they actually work in practice? Although it has to be said, there is, some of the intervention from Sex Matters and from the Scottish Lesbian Interveners, they added stuff in their intervention about various matters of surveys and stuff which had been taken. But I didn't think it was up central to the decision. The court certainly saw it very much as a question of statutory interpretation, precisely because the law had been passed and the issue was, what does the law mean? If you want to change the law, and that seems to be what so much of what's the objection to this judgment is, the law has come up, the law is not as people had thought it had been. It isn't protecting trans people sufficiently. So that what that therefore means is you therefore seek to change the law, and you do that by going to the legislature and you present the evidence, and then all the policy matters are taken into account. But the courts do not and cannot act as policy judges. So it wasn't appropriate for evidence to be heard, and evidence wasn't heard, and it wasn't actually taken into account. There was some passing reference, certainly from my client, some passing reference to experiences from in Sex Matters in terms of surveys, as I understand it, but they weren't my clients. So in terms of changing the law, that's what one does. The idea also that they didn't properly take into account a human rights reading of it, the human rights arguments were put forward, completely put forward. As I say, the Equality and Human Rights Commission were involved and they supported the position of the Scottish ministers and of Amnesty International in terms of what the law actually meant. The Equality and Human Rights Commission also said, in practical terms, that might cause difficulties, and therefore that would be a matter for the legislature, not for the courts. to determine. But a human rights reading under Section 3 of the Human Rights Act says one can change a normal reading of a statute in order to comply with the requirements of the convention right, if and insofar as possible. And we know from Guiden against Gordon Mendoza that that means it's got to go with the grain of the legislation. And in this case, they went and discovered the grain of the legislation and said they could only, all these provisions, notably about pregnancy and maternity protections, only make sense. And there's only one definition of women, if women means biological women. So issues around the misunderstandings before, the idea that trans women can only be excluded from same-sex services if there's a legitimate proportionate reason and all the rest of it, that was a misunderstanding, because if trans women were included in women-only services, they were no longer single-sex species. And the issue about the exclusion of people with gender recognition for on a legitimate and proportionate reason would be the exclusion of trans men from spaces which are otherwise women-only in terms of individual cases. So it was never the case, notwithstanding the assertions to the contrary, that it had been the case that trans women would be presumptively admitted into women's only spaces, but could only be excluded on in terms of legitimate grounds. If they were in a women's only space, it was no longer a women's only space. You have to justify why you're having a women's only space under other considerations, which are to do with privacy, decency, intimacy, and all the rest of it, but not proportionality. Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you. And there's a further question. I'll just from Roman Irvin. It says you mention that your case relied on a review of legal history and how the law has been frequently used to disregard women's rights. Given society's growing recognition of trans marginalisation, please can you explain how this is not another example of the law legitimising the oppression of already marginalised group, especially when the Scottish Government's aim was to improve women's access to politics and affect only a very small proportion of women who identified as transgender. Thank you.
Yeah, and that argument was very, very strongly and eloquently put by the Scottish Government. This is all about their policy, their declared policy for 10 years to stop trans marginalisation. I was arguing for my clients, for Women Scotland, saying, yes, but the problem, and this is an argument, I'm putting forward the argument, as it turns out the court accepted it, but I'm there to argue a case. But what my argument was, well, one's focusing on trans rights and trans rights as fundamental rights, but you are forgetting and not even taking into account the impact that that might have on women and women's rights in terms of a biological definition of women. So, for example, one of the questions that came from the court was, well, these are positive action measures in the workplace for women, because women in the workplace experience, because of their as a sex, as a biological sex, they have historically suffered less representation in senior positions. And it was clear, I mean, even before the court, it was all men who were arguing the case, just about, apart from the Scottish minister, said instructed two women. Otherwise, all the people speaking were men, and the majority of the court were men. But women as a biological sex are the ones who are suffering discrimination, institutional discrimination, and need of positive action measures. How is that going to help women if you have people who have had professional careers and then later in life transition, and therefore will be able to claim those positive action measures if they had been natal men who then transition in later life? That is that dealing with the institutional discrimination aspects of it? The court asked, because that was a concern about it. So women's rights were centred by me against the background of the undisputed historical, as the cases I quoted showed, institutional discrimination against women. Even now, there's a gender pay gap, and the Equal Pay Act has been enforced for half a century. You know, there's something a bit odd going on, frankly, if even 50 years on, women are still being paid less than men. And that was another issue. If you're then putting people who were natal men and had careers as men and then transitioned later into equal pay cases, then you're going to skew the statistics there too.
Thank you very much for that. There's a lot of questions.
Oh, can sorry. I maybe also jump on that?
Yeah, of course. Sorry, I've got the questions up. Yeah, go ahead.
I totally understand. So I think since this has been now raised a few times, I also wanted to say something on voices heard in the case. I think we do need to think about like what is the knowledge basis for judges to come to their decisions. I didn't mention a few cases where actually women's rights were restricted or were not recognized in history, and also mentioned that the judges who took this decision were mainly men. Also mentioned some cases where the issue at stake were the rights of Black people, such as enslaved people, and the judges were white. Obviously, I think we should think about the representativeness of our judicial bench, but we also should not like fall into the trap to just assume being a man or a woman or being white or Black is necessarily determining our view of the law, because that would really go against kind of anti-essentialist stances also fought for by intersectional feminists. But I think we do need to think about like what is the knowledge and what are the lived experiences, what is the type of information which courts rely on. And in this case, I think the interventions have played a crucial role. I didn't also mention how strongly the judgment relies on the intervention by Sex Matters, which was providing a written intervention as well as an oral intervention. And also the court strongly relies on the interventions of the three kind of lesbian organizations which intervened on behalf of the claimants or on the side of the claimants, and also relied quite heavily on the intervention of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, but does not engage with the intervention from Amnesty in substance at all. It mentions Amnesty had provided an intervention, but it does not engage with the intervention as such very much. So I do really think that we have to think about like what are the voices which have been heard here, what are the type of information and the knowledge which has been heard, and whether I don't completely understand why like these interventions were permitted, and like for example the interventions by the two experts who work on trans rights and who have also lived experiences were not included. So I do think that this is a very kind of important kind of question to raise about the case. I think I would have other things to say, but let's see whether there's another question.
Okay, thank you. There are a number of questions coming in. Aidan, you might not feel able to answer this one, but Maggie Chapman, MSP member of Scottish Parliament, accused the Supreme Court of bigotry, prejudice and hatred following the ruling. Thoughts on that and the fact that she's allowed to continue as deputy chair of the Scottish Parliament Equality Committee?
Well, she got the casting vote on her staying as deputy chair of the Equality Committee. It's slightly odd. But I mean, I think she slightly backtracked on the comments by saying she was saying there was bigotry, prejudice and oppression. But she's not saying any individuals are like that in the Supreme Court as a result of the decision. But, you know, politicians are politicians. I mean, they will say what they will say. And it's beyond my pay grade to... Although clearly not Rory Dunlop, who has tweeted on that. But he is the Dean of the Faculty of Advocates. But also, I think he's given up on Twitter now because he's taken up a part-time judicial role. So the rest is politics.
Thank you. I'm conscious that our time's running out. Jake Solway asks a interesting question, which is essentially forward-looking. And perhaps you want to... start with this, Lena. What do you think will be the eventual outcome of policy adopted by different institutions as a result of this judgment? Will the interim directions be adopted or changed? And perhaps I might just wrap into that an earlier question, which is essentially, what about the position of trans men going into, for example, female or vice versa?
Okay, yeah, let me start with the last question, because so I mean, according to the judgment now, like the position is that trans men cannot use, well, according to the interpretation by the Equality and Human Rights Commission of the judgment, is that trans men cannot use men's bathrooms, yeah, but have to use women's bathrooms, as well as should not be allowed to access men-only services, but should be included in women-only services. So we will have men who present as men, who look men, and who should be included in women's only services. And now this provision on proportionality for achieving legitimate aim pertains to their exclusion. So trans men cannot enter a man's services. They can categorically, they should enter women's services, but they can be excluded as well. So just showing also kind of the precarity of the situation here, because that can result in like men not having access to certain services. But okay, let's hope that proportionality is applied and we do think about whether there's available alternative services. Okay, so regarding the future, so I do think that there will be legal challenges to the draft code of practice, which is out. There's a consultation going on. And the judgment by the UK Supreme Court can obviously not be appealed at the ECTHR, but basically the results, the consequences can be appealed if it gets there, basically. If the domestic courts decide against some of the challenges, then I think there will be a challenge pending at the ECTHR. I think we will see how different institutions actually follow the code of practice of the EHRC. And I think lawyers will also be needing to be inventful in order to kind of make sure that some women's spaces can remain kind of trans-inclusive.
Thank you. And Aidan, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I'm sorry, but women's spaces can't remain trans-inclusive if it means including trans men. They no longer are women's spaces according to the law. And it's kind of somewhat paradoxical for me, but I don't think this is the case for further litigation. It's hopeless because you've got a Supreme Court unanimous decision. They're not every judge, every lower court is bound by that decision. It's actually not badly reasoned as a decision. Most of the arguments are taken from the cases that were before, the written cases. So you are, in a sense, wasting all the time and money by saying there's any hope for any kind of litigation. The idea that the Equality and Human Rights Commission guidance, it's got to fall within the four corners of the law as interpreted by the Supreme Court. It cannot, as it were, change that law or that decision in any way at all. It's quite a comprehensive decision. So, if you want to change the law, litigation is not going to do it. What we have to do is, if you want to change the law, is change the terms of the Equality Act. That's where it's political efforts that should be being done. And frankly, I've done enough attempts at applications to the European Court of Human Rights in cases which I think there were even far stronger grounds than any of this. And the Strasbourg at the moment is not up for second guessing or accepting even applications which attempt to overturn unanimous decisions of the UK Supreme Court. They've got other things on their plate which they're more interested in, which are primarily to do with the protection of democratic freedoms in the Eastern Europe, former Soviet bloc. So I don't see any attempt to make an application to Strasbourg as having any stateable prospects of success, even getting over the threshold of being allowed to make the application.
Well, on that note, oh, sorry, Lena, go ahead.
I just wanted to say one thing is like, so one has to think about like what the single-sex spaces then, based on this new definition, do in terms of creating indirect discrimination for trans persons. And interestingly, actually, one of the absurd effects of this case, if you look at the code of practice which was issued yesterday, is that it might become even harder to justify the existence of single-sex spaces such as women-only spaces. Because in order to justify the existence of women-only spaces, one has to show that this is a proportionate means for achieving a legitimate aim. Since single-sex spaces then can create the fact that like trans persons do not have access to like appropriate services as such anymore, the threshold to justify that these are proportionate is higher. And that becomes quite clear by looking at the code of practice. So indirect discrimination will be also one of the tools which will be used by lawyers in order to ensure the rights of trans persons.
Thank you. I think our time is up, and I think we've got to call it a day. I'm hugely grateful to both of you for your extraordinary insights. And I'm also, for the first time ever, I think, Aidan, I've heard you say, no more litigation, lots more legislation. I'll hold you to that next time I see you in the court. But thank you very much. And thank you to all who've joined us online. And thanks to Dan and Sarah for keeping all the technology going. Thanks very much and goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye now. Thank you.